We acknowledge the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which company has been recorded, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation.
We respect their continuing culture and the past and present contributions they have made to this region. Sovereignty was never ceded.
You're listening to Company, the podcast connecting Australian artists,
where we talk all things professional, personal, and spiritual.
Joining you as always are your hosts, Georgia Kennedy
and Tiana Catalano.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of Company.
Yes, this is episode number 10 or 11? We didn't celebrate our 10th episode, did we?
Know.
Oh no, this is it. No, this is the 10th episode. Well, congratulations to us. Well done, Georgia.
It is 10? Oh, it actually is the 10th. Oh my God, that's so exciting. Yay.
So good. So good. And how are you feeling, Georgia?
How am I feeling? I'm feeling good today. We spoke to Tariq yesterday or the day before, and it was super inspiring. I didn't even mention, today's episode is with Tariq, who is the founder of AOC, which, if anybody doesn't know about that, AOC is a scholarship for musical theatre artists in Australia. It's super exciting. It's something that Tariq created a few months ago. So we had an awesome chat with him about that.
Yeah. And we're not running behind, but it was a bit of a last minute recording because we have been in a show and now it's done. And it was a big week and it was just so nice to be back on stage and performing, I think. But now we're a bit brain dead this week, having a break.
Yeah, this week's our week off.
Which is not really a week off, but a week to catch up. So before we get started with the interview, how about we'll do a riff of the week?
Yeah.
Okay. Riff of the week. Riff of the week.
Okay, so my riff this week is a TV series that my boyfriend and I had started on Netflix. It's called Ratched. And it's another Ryan Murphy series. So if anyone's seen American Horror Story or Hollywood, same person. Oh my gosh, it's so good. And it's based on the nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So it's like a pre-story to that. And it has Sarah Paulson in it, and I love her. Like, I think she's in every American Horror Story series. She's a phenomenal actress. I'm obsessed. And there are such stunning aesthetics and paired with such intense and dark themes, and it just leaves you, like, absolutely wanting more and also very confused because it looks amazing and all the colours are phenomenal, the scenery and everything, but the actual story of, like, you know, lobotomies and all of those kind of treatments in psychiatric wards is so intense and gory, and yeah, it's phenomenal. And it's actually based on real experiences of, it's based on a novel, I can't remember the guy's name, but he basically was a night worker, like a night shift worker, and journaled all of these things that were happening within the ward. So to think that those things were happening is pretty insane. So I highly recommend it. And yeah.
Love it. My riff of the week is David Attenborough's new Netflix documentary, A Life on Our Planet. I've been putting off this documentary for a couple of weeks because I knew that I was just going to be in tears and it was really going to hit me hard. So I finally watched it last week and I cried about 6 or 7 times through it, like I knew that I would, but I really, really do think it is a must watch for every single person. We really need to do all that we can to help the planet, and David talks about many ways that we can do that and we can help the planet and help the animals and change our environment. And the sort of last note that he left it on is that the environment is gonna end up okay with or without us. But, you know, we humans, I think we want to stay on this planet and we want to keep evolving with the environment. So we really have to do all that we can to work in harmony with the environment and not work against it. Talks about animal agriculture as well and the effects that that has on the environment. So yeah, it's beautiful. It's powerful. You'll cry. But I think it really is a must. Why can't I say must watch? It's a must watch for everyone.
Yeah, I agree. I sadly watched that on Saturday night instead of going to a party. So then I felt really sad and I was like, I think I'm just going to go to sleep now. I didn't go out. And that just made me kind of depressed. But definitely, I agree, must watch. Mm.
Beautiful. Tarek Frimpong is a Ghanaian-Australian actor, singer and dancer from Melbourne. He made his feature film debut playing the role of Angus in Disney's 2018 film Mary Poppins Returns. Tarek played the role of young Simba in the Australian production of The Lion King musical. He also appeared in Bring It On the musical, playing the role of Twig in the Australian premiere.
Tarek has appeared as Principal Standby in Madiba, the musical, and he has appeared on the West End playing the role of Prince Abdullah in Disney's Aladdin the musical. Tarek has danced for numerous recording artists including Justin Bieber, FKA Twigs, Aston Marigold, Missy Higgins and Zoo. And most recently this year, Tarek has created the amazing AOC initiative, which we will be talking about today.
Hey, Tarek, it is so amazing to have you on the Company podcast.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we like to start off our interviews with asking if you have any arts recommendations for us.
Okay, yeah. Normally I'm quite like an avid reader, but recently I guess just been so busy with one, getting through the crazy lockdown that so many people are experiencing, as well as all the work I'm doing with AOC Initiative and I don't know, just being there for myself. I haven't been reading as much, but I guess some book recommendations I could give are Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Renee Edo Lodge is a book that I've read that I think is really great. And ironically enough, despite the name, I think it's an excellent read for white people. And I think it's super informative and I really enjoyed that. There's another book called, I believe it's called Why We Should All Be Feminists by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I might have said her name wrong there. But I think that's a brilliant book too, especially for men, because I think it is kind of a great introduction into feminism and intersectionality. And she also touches on, as a black woman, how sexism manifests specifically or highlights how sexism manifests in black communities or black cultures. And I think that's really interesting. And even kind of looking on it now, I guess I've always done a reasonable amount of reading. But it was kind of earlier this year that I reflected on throughout my schooling and things like that, how many, also I feel like I've just come in with you guys so hard about the message I stand for, but we're here and I love it. But I was kind of reflecting on how many books I'd read throughout my schooling and throughout my life and how many of those books were by authors of color or by black authors specifically. And it was quite shocking and surprising, even once I'd left school and was in charge of the books that I chose to read, how few black authors I could name that I'd read and really enjoyed and appreciated and learned from their work. So that's kind of something that I've been more focused on in regards to the books that I'm choosing to read. So there's those two that I think are great. There's another book called Growing Up Aboriginal in Australia that I'm reading at the moment by Anita Heiss, I think. I may have said her last name is wrong as well, so apologies. But I think that's also a great book, and I've talked about it before. It's essentially, she's curated all these stories, all these anecdotal short stories, letters, poems from Aboriginal people about their experiences growing up here in Australia. And I think it's incredibly poignant, incredibly powerful. And just hearing so many individual stories and hearing how they all intersect and where the similarities lie really paint a bigger picture of systemic issues and larger kind of issues that are occurring. And I think it's a book that should be taught in all schools realistically. I think it's really great because I think even if you're not a big reader, there are all these really bite-sized stories that have been curated. So you can sit down one night and literally read just two pages and it'll be like this poem that's really powerful and really interesting. Or then you can sit down the next week and maybe read an entire chapter which encompasses five different stories or letters between Aboriginal people and things like that. So yeah, off the top, I think they're kind of a couple or a few books that I'd recommend.
That's amazing. That's really beautiful. And I that rings true with me as well. I never really read books from people of color growing up, yeah. But it's not actually something that I thought about. I just kind of thought, well, that's the way that it is. And that's the way that Australia is. We don't really have many people of color, you know, writing books that are at the forefront of the Australian society. So to sort of actively choose to hear those voices now growing up is so, so, so important. So that's amazing. Those sounds like amazing recommendations.
Yeah, I think it's been really kind of reaffirming for me and powerful and exciting to hear. I think just hearing different voices in whatever space you are in, if you're always listening to music and always listening to the same type of music, it's nice to maybe if I'm only listening to rap to then go and listen to an operatic piece or a piece by an orchestra, and there's something exciting and exhilarating about that. So in the same way, I think it's also interesting because obviously in my schooling, which I did from prep to year 12 here in Australia, not all the books we read were necessarily Australian authors. Like we read English authors and American authors and things like that. And it wasn't something I noticed growing up at all either. And it wasn't really until this year, kind of in lockdown, and I sat down and was like, oh, I love reading. I tend to write little write-ups on the books I read and post them on my Instagram. And it's, I don't know, it's a nice kind of self-help, sort of self-healing moment of just reflecting on what I've learned from that book. And as I was listing them out, I was like, oh, wow, there's this real pattern here of that I actually couldn't name some of my favorite authors of color. I couldn't name some of my favorite black authors. I couldn't put a name to a few of these things. And I was like, that's really interesting. And I wonder what that would do for me and my psyche and my life by allowing other voices and other perspectives to enter my mind and my body through reading. So that's something that I consciously chose to do this year, really.
That's so cool. And I think, there's such a gap in schools in general about Australian history. We learn about everyone else's history, but not about our own. I think that needs to be a massive change. And I know we're trying to push for a, you know, wider spectrum of material within uni for, you know, because we're in our third year of musical theatre at WAPA. So, you know, we're trying to push for broader materials, and that's more female writers even. And they've just been so stuck in their way, and it's time to make a change and actually put the effort in to find those different materials. So yeah, that's really awesome.
Absolutely.
And I guess it'd be great to kind of get like a rundown, like what made you become an artist? Where did you start? How did you get to where you are now? Can you give us a bit of a brief rundown of that?
Yeah, for sure. So both my parents were professional dancers, and that's how they met, kind of traveling the world and dancing in shows and things like that. So I guess you could say it's been in my blood from a young age. So I remember being 4 years old, and my mum then also runs her own professional dance school. So I remember 4 years old being in my cot kind of thing and just always being around music and dance and performance and things like that. So I grew up training at my mum's dance school. Then I was, I think, 9 or 10 years old. I was lucky enough to play a young Simba in the Australian premiere of The Lion King. And that was the first time in my life where I got to perform professionally, I guess. And it's funny because prior to that, I didn't know what I wanted to do as a career, not because I didn't know that I loved performing, but because at 9 years old, I was never worrying about or considering what do I want to do as a job, or what do I want to do as a career, or what do I need to do to earn money to earn a living. I was just like, yeah, I love going to dance lessons, and I love singing along to this song in the radio, and I love school choir or whatever it was. So that was my first professional experience. And I think that was, it was from that moment onwards. It was really interesting. We had an AOC initiative workshop, industry panel Q&A last night. And Jamie Lee was one of the people that spoke on this panel. And she actually did The Lion King with me back in 2005 or 2006, whenever it was. And it was really interesting to hear that she actually had the same experience, that that job for her reaffirmed for her that that was what she wanted to do for the rest of her life, that that was her purpose. And I definitely had that exact same experience. It was getting to do that, that I was like, oh, this is amazing. This is really fulfilling. This really inspires and excites me. And this is what I want to do professionally or as a job or as a career for the rest of my life. In hindsight too, and I look back at it, and I, at the time, obviously I was not ignorant to it. It wasn't something that I even kind of considered, but in hindsight, I'm like, how amazing that The Lion King, specifically a show that celebrates, African culture in such a powerful and beautiful and colorful way, how lucky I was that that was my first experience into this world with the music and this cast from all over the world. And in reflection, I'm like, wow, that was some sort of divine timing, like great way to start. So that was my first professional gig. And then from there, kind of just went back to school and kept doing the normal things. And then I've been lucky enough to do a few other really cool jobs. So I've done the Australian premiere of Bring It On, the musical, which was amazing. I did a show called Madiba, the musical, which is based on the life of Nelson Mandela, which again was incredible. And I learned so much about myself and about South Africa's history and apartheid and everything like that. I've also been a part of Aladdin on the West End, which was amazing to get a taste of, I guess, West End and what that's like. I've also been lucky enough to do a large number of dance jobs, including, I feel like I'm just listing my CV here, but you might be impressed to someone. But dancing for Justin Bieber and touring the world with FKA Twigs and Missy Higgins and Aston Marigold and a whole bunch of other performers, and Tiala Settle on the Graham Norton show. And then I also got to be a part of the Disney feature film Mary Poppins Returns, and work alongside Lin-Manuel Miranda and Emily Blunt, and get a taste of, I guess, what working on a feature film is like. And I really just got thrown into the screen world and got to experience how that differs from the stage.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, and I mean, even going back to the start of you listing your incredible career so far, what stuck out to me and what stuck out listening to Jamie yesterday is that from 9 you had this dream, and you had, I think you kind of had to have had this confidence in yourself and this belief in your talents and the stories that you have to tell, that it sounds as if that didn't really falter as you got older. I think a lot of us maybe go, oh, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, I'll go and work at a desk job, or I'll try something else because this is all too hard. But it sounds like you have a real incredible fight and belief in yourself and what you have to bring to the arts industry that is so, so admirable and so amazing.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I guess that's something that's interesting to reflect on, because obviously at 9 years old, I definitely didn't have that. And it's funny, I don't know, when you have that naivety of your youth, like I remember going into that audition and I wasn't nervous because I didn't know what an audition was. I didn't really understand the concept. I was 9 years old. I think I got a day off school and I was getting to go and like learn to get a free dance class. I was like, this is great. And then they're like, oh, can you say these lines and pretend to be a lion? And I'm like, yeah, how fun. This is amazing. So you know what I mean? I didn't have that kind of, I guess, nervousness, or I don't know, it's negative self-talk or anything like that. When I think back, I'm like, wow, I wish I could go back to that, because that's really great. And it's interesting because as I've gotten older and had more experience and things like that, I think I've definitely developed I believe in myself no matter what kind of thing. I like thoroughly and wholeheartedly believe that if I put my mind to anything, I can achieve it, whatever that is. And I guess that can come across as potentially arrogant or things like that, but I know in my heart of hearts that it's not. That's not the way I choose to project out onto anyone, but that's just how I feel intrinsically. And realistically, all I do is try to inspire anybody that I cross paths with to develop that own internal unwavering self-belief that they are capable of whatever it is they wish to put their mind to. So that's interesting, because that was something that I can't pinpoint when that happened, but as I was in my early teens, I did kind of have that. But at the same time, that's not to say, and it was interesting to hear a few people touch on it in the industry Q&A last night, that also, I guess, as your career develops or as you have more experience, there's sometimes then the added pressure. I guess some people might think, well, you've done this job and this job and this job, so now you're just, of course, you're going to believe in yourself and work towards your goals. But I guess you lose that naivety in the same way, and then you worry about expectations. And then it's like, oh, well, I have done this job and this job and this job, so walking into this room, I'm expected to be able to provide this, or I'm expected to be at this level. And maybe, I don't know, because of circumstances, because of like the particular day of that particular audition and the last conversation you had and how that affects your performance, there's so many different elements that can affect you. So there's just that kind of added pressure. But yeah, I feel like I've rambled here and I had something else to say, but it's left me and it might come back to me.
Nah, I really enjoyed hearing you say that, because I think something that I'm really intrigued in at the moment is like finding that inner child and remembering a time when this was just joy. It didn't matter how you sang, it didn't matter how you danced, it was just all driven from joy, like as a child. And then you, like you said, it's all the external factors that then come into it, and then things can get blurry and things can be forgotten, and you go, why am I even doing this in the first place? So that's such a gift to like not have that, you know, take over and like lose that joy. And it's definitely, I think that's one of the, not the downfalls of like institutions sometimes, but it can be, because you go into an environment where it's driven by comparison and like competition rather than really embracing who you are as an artist and like what you bring and what you enjoy. So yeah, that's amazing that, you know, you've found that like self-belief and like, please, like, you know, bring it over here. Yeah.
Please take it. Even hearing you say that, yeah, just kind of reminded me of something that I was going to say about, yeah, how this, I don't think it's like purely institutions either. It's just the nature of the industry. It's actually wild when you think about it, or when you talk about how the performing arts industry works to anybody else in other field. And it's like, oh yeah, to get a job, I go into a room with 100 other people, and I learn a dance routine, and then I do it in a group of six, and the person on the other side of the table says, yes, no, yes, actually, can you do a backflip right now? No, sorry, can you please go home? And it's direct comparison, it's direct judgment, it is all those things, and then you get rejection after rejection after rejection. I think it's so important to touch, and it was interesting to hear, again, I feel like I'm going to reference this Q&A so much, because I sat there and was like inspired and learned so much. But I think no matter how successful anyone is, and I guess I can really only speak from my own perspective, but I know that I've had 10 times more rejection than success. Like for every one job I've received or achieved or got, I've had more than 10 rejections, definitely. And they are hard to deal with, and they are hard to cope with, and they are painful and upsetting. And I think it's just important to build a strong support network around you and work out how you best deal with that rejection. I don't think there's a one shoe fits all or one size fits all approach to dealing with that. I feel like it's not touched on a lot, but like when I miss out on jobs, I like cry. I'll be like at home like crying, because I'm like, I care about this so much. Like I want to do this so much. Like I attach myself to the project through the audition process, which some people say not to do, but I don't see how you could give your best audition otherwise if you weren't attached to it. At the same time, once the audition is over and I've done all I can do, I then try and detach and forget that it ever existed. But then when you get that call or that email from the agent, they're like, oh, sorry. I remember vividly one day in London. I'm so rambling here, but I feel like rambling's kind of good, because I might go down a different path that I've not been on other interviews. But I remember vividly this one day in London, and I'd been auditioning for two shows, actually. One was the UK tour for Beautiful, and one was, oh, this play that I forgot, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And I'd been auditioning for both of them, and had been probably in at least three times, I think maybe four times for Beautiful. And it got down to like the recording stages where they like recorded and sent you off to American creatives or whoever needed to be. And I was like, two auditions, one's going to come through for me. Like, this is great. Like, I've got double the chances. And I remember I got like the one call from my agent for both no's. So it was like one call, and she was like, oh, like, I just wanted to let you know, unfortunately, like neither of those jobs went your way. And I just remember it hitting me quite hard. I'm not sure if it was because two on the one day, I'm not sure if it's because of what I ate for breakfast that morning or the last conversation I'd had, but I think all those factors play a role in making you feel a certain way. But I just remember crying and being so upset, but at the same time I ensure that I have a strong support network around me, can call family and friends and talk about that, and then go and do things that help me feel good about myself and just things that bring me joy. And that, I guess, links to the finding that inner child again. That's something that I think I've always tried to do, and I still definitely remain conscious of, thinking back to now, peddling back to this Lion King audition when I was a child, when I had that naivety and didn't know what an audition was. Like, I generally don't remember feeling nervous about, and that's not even like a, oh, no, I'm not nervous performer trying to psych yourself up. And it's like, no, but deep down you do feel those little butterflies. I was like, no, at nine, I was like chatting to my best mate in the line, literally not caring, being like, this is great, about to go in. And then I remember it got to like the final stages of the callback for the young Simba and young Nalas, and they did this thing called Cub School. And also, this is, the industry is wild. When I explained to people that we did this at 9 years old, it's like, what's going on? But we went into the VCA building every day from like 9 till 3 p.m. on the school holidays for 2 weeks, Monday to Friday. And it was essentially a workshop audition. So 9 to 3, you would go in there and you would learn all the pieces. But it started off with, I want to say it started off with like 10 potential young Simbas and 10 potential young Nalas. Go in every day, learn the songs, dance, do lines, work on, I don't know, accent and whatever it is, and learn about the history of the show. And it was the best thing ever because it was so much fun and getting to go in and do this. And I think it was paid. It was like, oh my God, I'm 9 years old and getting money. This is crazy, which is kind of gross when you think about it. But at that stage, then I started to feel the nerves. Then I started to feel pressure because the way it was done too was that you would go in every day with all 19 of your other mates, work every day on this material, so great. And then on the drive home at about 5 or 6 p.m., your parent, well, it happened to be the drive home for me because of how far away I live, but at about 5 or 6 p.m., you would get a phone call from the producers and would say, unfortunately, your son or your daughter hasn't been successful, so we don't need them to come back tomorrow. So it was kind of like some Big Brother house-esque audition process. And obviously that was done in the nicest way possible. Like there was no maliciousness or anything like that. But just when you think of the concept, it's like, this is wild. And I remember sitting in that car on the drive home, and if it got to 5 or 6 p.m. and the phone rang, you were like, do we answer the phone? Who's calling? And like sometimes it would just be family or whatever. And it was just a really strange situation. So when I think back to that, I was like, it was still at 9 or 10 that I started to feel, I guess, that kind of pressure and nervousness around auditions that can sometimes not help not help the way you execute in an audition room and things like that. But that, touching onto childlike joy one more time, then I'm going to get off this question, sorry. you said that and it's triggered me in the best way. I do remember that, and despite like the fact that we were at this 9 to 3 workshop audition, I just remember the lunch breaks. And the lunch breaks, we would go across to the park across from like VCA, and we would just like run around and like play Tiggy and like try and do backflips, and like I'm bringing a soccer ball and like playing soccer. And that was like such a highlight, and that was such an escape. And it wasn't in the back of your mind thinking about, oh, but should I spend lunch going over my lines that I've been over 100 times, or should I try and work out a different intention for this line to maybe make it more poignant? It was like, no, it's lunchtime. I'm about to go and kick the soccer ball and try and score 10 goals. Like, this is great. And I think back to that, and I think that same premise is important to try and apply for your life. And I think that's what I do when I receive rejection in auditions, or even when I'm just in the biz and everything's a bit hectic. It's like I try and find my version of going to the park and playing soccer and whatever that is to help me escape, and like what does not relate to art in any way. And yeah, whatever that is for you, whether it is reading or whether it is playing soccer or whether it is, I don't know, going to the beach or whether it is, I don't know, anything. I think that's so important. Anyway, I'm done blabbing on about that.
Yeah, that's so funny though, because we just did a chorus line and I went through that stage where I was just like, oh, I've only got an hour break, and like we've been dancing all morning, and like I got to stretch, I got to like do something. Meanwhile, the boys are outside just kicking the football, and I'm like, God damn, like stop kicking the damn football. But then I thought about it, I was like, but they're having fun. So yeah, maybe I should do that. And like I definitely do it when it's like the weekend. Like I barely do work on the weekends, which is like a bit naughty, but it's like my time to be like, oh, I'm a normal person, and like whatever happened in these past 5 days, it doesn't matter on the weekend. I'm just going to do normal stuff and just feel really, you know, happy with that. And yeah, it's hard to find that balance and know when, you know, you need to kind of take a look at everything and go, ah, am I actually like enjoying this, or am I like running myself into the ground and like not actually getting anywhere because you're just worrying about things that don't need to be worried about?
Yeah. And it's such a fine balance between giving your all to auditions and giving your all to performing and arts, and then being able to sort of leave that at the door and go home and not carry the show or carry those feelings with you. And I think that's something that I really struggle with. And I think I'm really glad that you touched on it and touched on the tears and the emotion that you feel when you get rejected, because you,
if you saw me, I'm a mess. I'm a mess. Like I think about it, I'm like, I was so good for this. I did so well. I tried so hard. That's my process, and I have to let it out, and then I have to. And then that's why I also know it's important that I have, and I think it's so important for everyone to find what it is, because I think if you don't have something to help you let go of it and leave it at the door, then it's near impossible. I don't think it's realistically impossible if you are attached and in it and giving your all, which is what is required of performers. There's this random quote that I saw from somebody on Twitter years ago, and it was like, to be in the theater is so painstakingly impossible because you have to have an open enough heart to like attach and give to the audiences and become other characters and love these other characters, but you have to have a resilient enough heart to take the constant rejection. And it's exactly that. And I think that's why it's so important to have something else, because if you do have a bad day at work, which is also what you love, and therefore feel like you are not serving your purpose well and all these things, or if you do receive that rejection and you don't have something in place and you don't have a process, then you're going to go home and feel like crap, and it's going to be detrimental to so many parts of you. But if you do have something that you know, that whether it is kicking the footy or whether it is playing chess, whether it is like whatever it is, something to help you escape and remove yourself, I think that is so beneficial and really helps. And
I really do think you never know what closed door could lead to an open door. I remember I did my Hamilton audition last year, and I was so excited. And it was an amazing, incredible experience. And to be in front of the Broadway director and musical director was a dream come true. And I adored the process, and I adored just dancing to the room where it happened. And I left that audition and I was like, that was incredible, amazing. Obviously, I didn't get into Hamilton. And I was devastated, mostly because I thought, well, that's it. That was the only show that was going to be available to me. And when I leave WAPA, there's going to be no shows for people of color, and I'm going to be in the ensemble for the rest of my time in musical theater. And what am I doing? And I spiraled in that kind of way, because I was holding on so tightly to the one show that I thought would be available for people like me. Little did I know that coronavirus would come this year and people like you would create the ASC initiative, and the Black Lives Matter movement would happen, and there would be an awakening in the arts industry as to, you know, how underrepresented people of color are. And I'm so grateful for that Hamilton audition, because it was such a beautiful experience. And I know why I didn't get in. And I just think, hindsight is so, so interesting, and it's incredible what has come since then.
Absolutely. It's really cool to hear you talk about that, because I think that's something that's also so important, and another thing that's so difficult about our industry. But I think just for everyone, like, something I pride myself on and something that I try and lead with is like the fact that I consider myself relentless. And I think anybody in this industry has to be relentless, because like you said, you get caught up on maybe this one show or this one role, and I just bumped my headphone, but you get caught up on this one show or this one role or working for this one person or giving this one particular performance or producing tears on this one line. And if it doesn't happen, you're a failure. If it doesn't happen, you're not good enough. If it doesn't happen, you'll never work again. And sometimes there's some, not the never work again, but sometimes there's some truth to it, that maybe there are limited roles for, you know what I mean? Somebody that looks like you, or somebody of your gender, somebody of your sexual preference or your ethnicity and all these things. And the wild part about it is that you have to remain relentless despite it all. And it is going to sometimes be more difficult for some than others, but it's just like, unless you, I feel like I'm quoting High School Musical here, but unless you keep your head in the game, like, you know what I mean? That then, like you said, those open doors will fling open and you won't be standing in front of it. And it's so difficult because I also wrestle with that. And I'm like, yeah, I understand that. But that's also just something we say to make ourselves feel good. And it is that, but there is also truth to it as well. You know what I mean? It's kind of, unless then to quote Hamilton, you've got to have skin in the game to stay in the game. Like, so it's just, yeah, being relentless and despite it all, trying to continue to show up, which I think is so important because, again, it's funny, I'm so skeptical and like, you never know what's going to happen or everything happens for a reason. I constantly wrestle with these big quotes that I definitely understand their importance and how powerful and impactful they are for a lot of people, but I just wrestle with them and how they play out in my life. But you do never know what's around the corner. Like, I think that's the arbitrary nature of life. Like, you just don't know what audition's going to pop up or who's going to try and start this initiative to change the game or who's going to call you or what idea is going to pop into your head to be like, oh, I need to write this right now and do it myself. Or, you know what I mean? You literally never know what's going to happen. On the other flip of the coin, nobody saw coronavirus coming in this way and switching things up. So yeah, you've just got to try and be relentless, hey, and stay with it and stay the course.
Yeah, I sometimes often resent the line everything happens for a reason, because I actually kind of disagree with that within my own life too. But I think if you stay relentless and you stay the course, and as you say, you have skin in the game, something will eventually happen for you. And it's just, life is kind of just sliding doors, isn't it? One door closed, this one opens, yeah.
And also when the things that happen that are, you know, so unfair and shouldn't be happening, it's like that moment to go, okay, well, I can either sink or swim in this situation. And yeah, everything does happen for a reason. And maybe this was put here to like push me to fight for something bigger. I think that's, yeah, it's like having those two kind of things married together is really powerful. Yeah. But you kind of touched on it before, and I'd love to hear what your experience was on Mary Poppins and what was the difference doing like a big feature film in comparison to stage performing.
Yeah, it was, please, as I go through, ask any specific questions you want, because I'm an open book and I will give them to you, and otherwise I might ramble on a tangent that's not exactly what you might want to hear. But it was the most amazing experience of my career. By far, just because it was, one, the magnitude of the project to the people I was working with. It's kind of like, sure, a job that I'd hoped that one day I would get to do, but sometimes you think maybe working in the theatre, that's not a reasonable jump or leap that you assume you're going to take. And especially the fact, I think I auditioned, it was such a long process. That was something that's really interesting. I think I auditioned when I was 22. And then it was like, months and months and months before I found out, and then months and months and months as we rehearsed and then kind of filmed, and then over a year of editing before it even came out at the end of 2018, I think the start of 2019. But yeah, it was the most incredible experience of my entire life. It was really interesting to see how it differs from theater. Obviously with theater, you have that immediate feedback of performing and having the audience either make audible reactions or at least have their energy emanating, having their eyes on you, having them hopefully give you a standing ovation if they really felt what you were putting out. Super interesting that obviously when you're doing something for screen, you don't have that. And especially working on a movie musical, you're giving the same outwards energy as if the audience was there. And one of the numbers that I was involved in was like this 10-minute dance number, and you're going for it and you finish and you hit the final post to silence, to hold, 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 cut. Thank you. We're going to go again from the top. And then you reset and you do it all again. It's also that repetition that you're not used to of, I don't know, people throw around the quote, film is forever. And it's kind of in the back of your mind. You're like, well, I can't give 80 on this one because what if this is the take they use? And you know what I mean? And my leg's not up by my ear or whatever is required isn't coming out. So there was that to deal with, like not having that immediate kind of the immediacy of an audience and that energy coming back at you. But at the same time, once the film comes out, there's something really powerful about the idea that your energy, your performance, and that art will reach a larger audience than just those in the space at that specific time. So the fact that my grandparents in Australia were able to see it, and family in America and friends all over the world and on cruise ships and things like that got to sit down and watch what I gave in that moment. There was something really exciting about that. Thinking about it now, I'm like, wow, that's really special.
What was the energy like in the room having Lin-Manuel Miranda in the space? Did it sort of change the energy?
Yeah, it's so wild. It's so wild because I think you think it's going to be this big thing. Like, I remember when he came into like the first music hall that we had for it, and I think we were all sitting there like, okay, yep, this is about to happen kind of thing, like Lin-Manuel. And then he walked in the room and he's just another person, and he walked in his trackies and like a hoodie and super casual and unshaven, and just was in rehearsal and was learning his part and was so approachable and so kind, and in a really positive way, didn't have any air about him whatsoever. He really just seemed like anybody that you've worked with or you'd see walking down the street or anything like that. So there was something comforting about that in a way. At the same time, I say that I think a lot of it too, maybe, I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with how you perceive certain people and things like that as well as the energy that they're giving off. Like, it's obviously a two-way thing. I could be like, he was so calm, and someone else can be like, no, I walked in the room and the room shook. And that's, you know what I mean? Their experience. But in saying that, I remember the first time I met Meryl Streep, and that was like wild. But again, I think it was me, but I think that was like the only person that I got like starstruck by. And I think she said hello to me, and I don't remember what came out of my mouth. Like, I generally think I blabbered and didn't make sense and then walked off because I just don't even remember the interaction. And I felt like she had an air about her. So I think, yeah, that was a funny and interesting experience. I'm trying to think with film. I don't know, it was just, I think the audition process was like vastly different. I think especially pre-COVID times when theatre auditions happened in real life and in the rooms, and you would go out and you would perform, and you would perform outwardly and look to the back wall like you're looking into the theatre. I'd obviously done a lot of auditions like that and felt comfortable and things like that. And then I remember getting to like my callback for this role, and because it's a screen project, I walked into a tiny casting office with one casting director sitting on a couch at the back of the room, one person working the camera and sitting maybe a meter away from me, and me standing in the one spot and them setting up the camera. And then they'll be like, great. And I'll read to you, and don't look at me. And there's your eye line. So it's like, I only have two other people in the room. One's a casting director in the back. One person's reading to me. And they were reading like they were reading in such a dry manner, like, which happens sometimes, you know what I mean? But I feel like, I don't know, in theatre, it's like often if you're doing dialogue, there'll be someone in the room, or the person gives you something to play off, or they might even stand in the space with you. This was me standing, realizing that I was only being shot from this space, and I'm trying to look, even though you're here, I'm trying to look here and give you my biggest Disney life-changing energy, but having someone read to me like, he was short of a sheet. I'm like, he was in the street! Like, and I'm like, it was just such a strange experience. I remember leaving. I remember being like, that was not great. And because then I guess you consider like that balance and realizing that, oh, they were only taking this much. How much is too much? And how does that read on the screen as opposed to how does it read in real life and things like that? So, yeah, that was a really interesting part of the audition process. And I think it's so different. I think the confined space, like, less people when they're sometimes miking you up and you have the script on the table, it just feels like vastly different to kind of walking in the space and saying hi to the pianist and putting my drink bottle down, and I can move around and having space, as opposed to like, no, you have to stand here, you can't move, like you can't move your feet because you're out of the shot, we're not panning with you, like this is your shot, now give us your performance. It's like, oh, it feels really restricting and things like that. I think if you come from a theatre background and maybe want to throw in bigger actions and dance moves and things like that, and I'm like, no, I have to stand right here and deliver this. And that was just interesting and, yeah, different to my theatre experience with auditions prior to that.
Mm. Incredible, yeah. It's so different, the
screen and stage. It's we're kind of doing some screen stuff at Whopper as well, and it's a whole different world. Even the whole kind of being too much on screen is hard because you're in like a little box. But that scene in Mary Poppins was absolutely incredible. I watched it with my grandma in the theaters, and we both loved it. Yeah,
it was gorgeous.
Yeah. So we obviously want to talk about the ASC initiative. It's absolutely incredible. First and foremost, when I read about it, I got really emotional that you would just take the initiative to do something like this for people of color in Australia. I think it's absolutely incredible and so admirable. And yeah, just thank you for building this. I wanted to ask, for people that don't know, what is the ASC initiative and what did it stem from? What gave you the drive to create something like this?
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Good question. So the ASC initiative is a musical theatre scholarship program which is designed to provide financial assistance and industry support to exceptionally talented theatre performers based in Australia who identify as Black, Indigenous or people of colour. And it currently manifests in the form of an online competition. And it was just born personally from a recognition of the underrepresentation of Black, Indigenous and people of colour performers in the industry. And it was me taking the initiative to do something to further the discussion around that and take a stance on that and do something in the space that I felt like was me physically doing something. So that was kind of where it was all born from, and that's essentially what it is.
Incredible. So did you sort of just one day think, I'm going to make the ASC initiative, and did you just start rallying people to get people on the panel, to get people behind the scenes? How did that come about?
Absolutely. So I'd been toying with the idea in general. I think as everyone, no matter what identity they are and what community you kind of fit in with, I think you're naturally in your life, whether you're speaking about it or not, you're dealing and considering and thinking about these things. So as someone that is a person of color, as someone that is Black, that is mixed race, it's, you know what I mean, racism or lack of diversity in regards to race in the industry that I'm a part of is something that I've always considered. They're discussions that I've always had, you know what I mean? I've been in the room and experienced interesting situations, which is a nice way to put it, you know what I mean? And things that really make you think and things like that. So it's always been something that's been in the back of my mind. I remember going into lockdown, I was toying around with the name Artists of Color and what that meant to me. And is that something that I was looking, I was like, oh, would I like to start a agency that represented people of color? And the idea from that was because of my own experience with agents that I've had in the past. And I have these like two incredible agents in the UK at the moment who are both white, and they're amazing. And we have such a fantastic relationship and have supported me through the biggest jobs of my career. But sometimes I come out of audition rooms where I have an experience that I need to articulate to someone, and because it's related to the audition and my career, my agent is probably the right person to speak about that with. And I guess I'm referencing microaggressions or sometimes maybe more overt things or just things that seem a little bit off to me, something I need to debrief on. And essentially your agent is the right person to debrief about that. But sometimes I personally maybe just feel reluctant to talk about that with them because they're white, through no fault of their own, like beautiful, incredible, loving, open people. But I just, for whatever reason, haven't felt comfortable. And then I end up going and talking to friends or other performers that are also POC. And they're like, yeah, same thing happened to me. Yeah, that's actually really whack. And that's not right. And that shouldn't have happened. And you're like, oh, okay, I feel better now. And it's not just me freaking out in my own head. So then I was like, oh, maybe I'll start an agency, because there's an agency that's kind of like a Black only agency in the UK. And I don't think that's something that exists in Australia. And I think there are benefits to that and things like that. So I was like, maybe I'd start the Artists of Color agency. And then I was toying with the idea of like, no, maybe I start the Artists of Color, and it's a program where I hold a bunch of training sessions and share my skills and my abilities and my talents and my thoughts on the industry, and my connections and networks and things like that with a group of performers of color to try and help them get a leg up and just help them up to the table in this industry, whatever table I'm at. So there were kind of initial thoughts that I was toying with. And then obviously the RGE announcement was made, and there was obviously this huge unwarranted backlash, and it was like this really big like shift, and people were coming more aware of like, oh, okay, this is such an overtly obvious example of a systemic issue. Like, nobody can deny this. I think it was, not that it's a good thing in any way, but it was great that it was so overt, you know what I mean? Because I think that's what caused so many people like, oh, there's a real issue here. Then when obviously there was a discussion that tried to take place, and then when certain people were really stuck in their way, that was like, oh yeah, great, this is a perfect example of how certain people working in certain institutions with a really ingrained mindset and a really ingrained kind of subconscious bias is what helps formulate systemic issues. And I think seeing that, having my own emotional response to that, seeing everybody else, and by emotional response, I mean, I saw it and I was just like, yeah, this sucks. And I was like, but I'm not surprised. And then it was just interesting to see everybody else rally and see how everybody else responded to that. And then at that moment, I was like, somebody needs to start a scholarship program similar to that, but purely to uplift the people that have been left out of Australia's biggest musical theatre program for the last decade. I was like, how does someone make up for that? Well, somebody needs to make a program that specifically supports these people this year in this time. And I was like, oh, well, realistically, it has to be a person of color, because just at the end of the day, if it was a white person, even like the most well-meaning white person, just I know from personal experience in the back of my head, I'd be like, oh, well, I want to be a part of it, but is this performative in any way, shape or form? Or how does this play into white saviorism or all these things? So I understood. I was like, it needs to be a person of color. But at the same time, it's like the people of color are the people that have been affected by this and maybe are feeling, you know what I mean, enraged or upset or crazy by all of this. So how frustrating that it's a person of color that's going to have to take on that heavy lifting and take on that added weight in this time. But again, it's that kind of paradox of, I understood that it needed to be a person of color for it to have the full impact. And I was like, oh, I need to do this. I was like, this is like an idea, I think as a creative, I think people can relate to that. You kind of, maybe you have ideas that fly in your head and you're like, oh, this would be a really good idea for a short film, or this would be a really good idea for a song, or things like that. And sometimes you latch onto them and sometimes you don't, and they fly away. Elizabeth Gilbert, the writer of Big Magic, actually talks about this in her book a lot, and about how ideas, you don't create them on your own, but essentially they fly around and enter your head. And if you choose to latch on, great, take it for a ride and you go for it. But if you don't, you let it go and it flies into someone else's head. And that's why sometimes somebody will be like, oh, I had this idea for an app. And you're like, I had the exact same idea. That's crazy. Just went on a ramble then. But anyway, it felt like one of those moments where this idea came into my head, and I've had many ideas in my life, and I've let many of these ideas go. And I was like, at this moment, I need to latch onto this, and I'm the person for this, with my place in the industry, with my skill set, with my belief, with the weight I feel comfortable taking on my own back right now. I was like, I need to do this. And then I went from there, and I just didn't really look back. And like I said, it kind of collided or combined well with the kind of unwavering self-belief I have that, if you tell me I can't do something, I'm going to do it 10 times and film it and send it to you. My like life mantra is, if you want something, go get it, period, from The Pursuit of Happiness with Will Smith. And I was just like, yeah, this is me right now. I can do this. I started and I talked it with a really great friend of mine in London. And he's actually the friend I referenced earlier, who, when I had been in auditions and felt slightly weird about certain experiences, like the person that I would go and speak to first, and he'd be like, yeah, that's weird. that's not really okay. And I'm like, oh, great. So anyway, I spoke to him and he's like, yeah, do this, let's go. How can I help? He has experiences developing websites. His name's Dane Ram. So he's like, I can set up the website for you if you design it and tell me what you want. Then I just got to work researching. And I think the first 48 hours or 4 days, and I think it was like the first 4 or 5 days after the RGE announcement had been made of their top 30, it felt like a bit of a blur, and I just felt like I didn't hear what was happening in the larger conversation because I was just working tirelessly on setting the infrastructure up and making sure that the website was up and how the program would run, and then shortlisting who I'd like to have on the panel and who I'd like to have come in and mentor, and how I was going to market this, and setting up the social media accounts, and working out what the industry support would be in terms of surprises and potential people I could reach out to, and how I could further things in regard to scholarships outside of the AOC, and getting more people of color into institutions like Village Nation or Patrick School of the Arts or VCA or wherever it is. So that those first 96 hours were a bit of a blur and just like working furiously. And then I've just stayed the course thus far, kept putting one foot in front of the other, and here we are.
That's incredible. It's incredible. And I know that there's obviously some really specific goals that we, you know, we slash you, the whole arts community want to fix. But for you personally, what is the biggest change that you want to see in the Australian arts industry for the future?
Yeah, right now, obviously, and what the AOC is advocating for and what I'm an advocate for is greater racial diversity in the Australian theatre industry. That's obviously not the only issue whatsoever. And there are arguably other issues that may be even larger. But I just know that's an issue that I am, that is a important issue, and it is a large issue, and it is the issue that I am primarily focused on right now. So I think that involves, like I've said before, it involves like reflection from everybody in the industry, which is so hard to have everybody to reflect on. It involves like, yeah, some really deep reflections, some really difficult conversations. And it involves, which is ironic because ideally artists, you want them to be open, but it really requires people to be open to listening and to talking and to hearing people of color and white people, everyone, you know what I mean? And just being like, okay, how did we get here? Why did this occur? Okay, what can we all do? How can we all play our part in, you know what I mean, improving the industry? So I think that's kind of, yeah, what I'm definitely focused on at the moment. So there's obviously it's having discussions with this, with yourselves, and discussions with anybody who's willing to discuss, reaching out to people to get them involved with AOC in any way, shape or form, whether that's reaching out to have people apply, whether that's reaching out to having people do Q&As, whether that's reaching out to people to be on the panel, whether that's reaching out to people to donate, getting as many people involved and getting this conversation out there as possible is so important. And I think also with what clearly the initiative or the scholarship is trying to do is it's not just about discussion, it's also about taking action, which is what the program is, and in the same way providing people with better financial support and industry support in regards to here you can get your headshots done for free with this top photographer, and you can have a meeting with this agent after, and things like that, and physically helping people get foot indoors, trying to hold doors ajar, trying to hold a rope down for more people to reach the table. That's kind of, I guess, how I visualize the work that I'm doing. So I think that's super important. And yes, another component to it is, as well as I feel like I'm really focusing on racial diversity, I guess, on our stages in the Australian theatre industry. But I think at the same time, I'm also trying to push the conversation of how important it is to have diversity, period, but especially racial diversity behind the scenes and not just on the stage. That's who's on the creative team for projects, that is who are the writers of the project, that is who is the stage management team, because I think, and I've said this quite a bit, but I think going forward from this point, if you're producing a show that represents or celebrates or champions racial diversity, or if it specifically tells the story of a person of color, but then behind the scenes, you're not celebrating that same diversity, it feels like to me like it's tokenism. And I just think it is tokenism, period. And because I think as an artist, if you don't stand for what your art, for the message of your art, then there's a mismatch there and there, you're not being true to the art. And I think that is wrong. you know what I mean? I think it's so important that if you are, yeah, portraying a particular message through your art, that you spend time with that and you think about it and you work out how that relates to you and why and how you believe in that. So yeah, there are a number of ways that I just kind of went on a little rant about, but I guess changes that I'd like to see and changes that I'm trying to be a part of and I guess lead by example with.
And you have touched on this in our chat today, but our last question for you is, what advice would you give to your younger self or young and up-and-coming artists in Australia?
Yeah, my advice for my younger self or any up-and-coming artist would be to just, as difficult as it's going to be sometimes, continue to show up for yourself and for others. Despite it all, despite whatever the specific issues are that are affecting you, despite the harshness of the rejection in our industry, despite the systemic issues that may affect you, despite everything, as hard as it is, please continue to show up. Because like we said, you don't know what's around the corner. You don't know how showing up is going to benefit you right then or in the long run. You don't know how continuing to show up is going to benefit other people around you. So that's what I'm trying to do now with the AOC. I'm here in this space, despite it all, showing up. And I just hope that younger Tarek would do the same thing and that anybody else maybe not sure how to continue right now is able to, yeah, continue to show up.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this chat with us. It's been absolutely amazing, so insightful, and we've loved it.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see the changes to come and when the world becomes a bit more of a normal place again and what we're able to achieve while it's not so normal and unstable. I think it's a really good time for reflection and to make those changes. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening to our episode with Tarek. I left feeling really inspired and he just has the most beautiful energy about him and he really cares about bettering the Australian arts industry and he's a really beautiful human and you can feel it even through the Zoom screen.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I really enjoyed that rant we had about the inner child. And it's made me very inspired to go and do some more thinking about the actual things that give me joy and why I don't believe in myself. And that was so inspiring to hear Tarek, you know, saying it's not in a cocky way or anything, but just like absolutely believing that you are capable of anything as long as you put your mind to it. It was just, yeah, wow. Mm. Wow. So cool.
Yeah. Oh, he's beautiful. Love him, love his work, love the ASC initiative, and make sure to check them all out.
I think this guy's the best bit.
You can laugh.
I don't know. Thank you for listening to this episode of Company. If you want to find out more about Tarek, you can follow him on his Instagram at Tarek Frimpong. And you can find out more about the AOC Initiative on their Instagram at AOC Initiative. Or you can donate to their scholarship at the AOC website. If you enjoyed this episode, let us know on our Instagram at Company Pod or our Facebook page. Also make sure to leave a review on our iTunes or Spotify. Big shout out to myself, Dave Duquettis, for producing this episode, our media queen, Deirdre Koo, also known as Deedle Dum Designs, and to the gorgeous Tiana and Georgia for letting me do this outro.
You're welcome.
You're welcome, bye.
See ya.
See ya.